From WAMU 88.5 at American University in Washington, welcome to the Politics Hour starring Tom Sherwood. I'm Kojo Nandi. Tom Sherwood is our resident analyst and a reporter for NBC4. He's also a columnist with the Current Newspapers, who is not in the habit of making New Year's resolutions, but one gets the impression that this year you intend to breathe a lot more deeply. Why is this?
Well, you're making a reference to my Northwest Current column about breathing.
Yes.
You know, I always think the week between Christmas and New Year's is the week to kind of take a deep breath. And just for you, I'm not, you know, as I said, I'm not looking to buy a pair of yoga pants. But I do think deep breathing has helped me over the last couple of years. I often do deep breathing exercises on the way to work. It's about 8 miles across town. The first 4 miles, I listen to news and what's happening. And the last 4 miles, I do deep breathing exercises and listen to classical music.
Well, I don't know what kind of exercises, maybe deep breathing exercises, that some officials in Prince George's County need to do, because it would appear that even as the county is trying to get over the last major corruption scandal involving the county executive, here we come with another major corruption scandal, this time not involving the county executive. What it shares in common with the last scandal is liquor stores. The liquor store was involved in the last scandal. Yeah. You got liquor stores involved in this scandal.
It's the devil's work. It's the devil.
Bribing officials in this situation.
Well, you know, the stories are talked about how there might be some more charges brought against elected officials. I really want to know who those people are, not just the liquor board members. You know, Rashern Baker, the county executive, said it. You know, this is a real setback on the war against unethical and illegal behavior. And people are innocent until proven guilty and all of that. But Prince George's County doesn't need this type of corruption. You know, going forward with the redevelopment, with the casino opening, who Lord knows when we're going to have a story of somebody leaving a baby in the parking lot of the casino or something like that. But this is the county that's trying to put the big boy pants on. It wants the FBI to, and the people, I've already joked that maybe the FBI shouldn't go to Prince George's County, make it easier for the FBI agents to get there to investigate corruption. But this is just a terrible setback. And it's such low level stuff. It's like giving $1,000 and $5,000 bribes, dropping them off in the men's bathroom of a restaurant. It's just, you know, remember Jack Johnson? We talked about stuffing the wad of money into the brassiere, his wife, and it's just low rent. I've always said, if you're going to be corrupt, go big, because people are less likely to catch you.
And as I said in the billboard, the liquor store owner who was caught up in that scandal went to jail, was sentenced to 4 years in December of 2011. The ink hadn't dried on that sentence before these others allegedly started cooking up their own bribery scheme.
You know, I just find it astonishing that people will bet their lives, bet their reputations, bet their livelihoods on such small potato stuff.
We're expecting later in the broadcast Sharon Bulovich. She is the chairman of the Fairfax County Board of Supervisors. And our guest in our first segment is Vincent Gray. He's a D.C. council member representing Ward 7. He's the former mayor of the District of Columbia. If you have questions or comments for him, you should start calling now, 800-433-8850. You can send email to kojo@wamu.org. Shoot us a tweet at Kojo Show or go to our website, kojoshow.org. Watch the live video stream of the broadcast and ask a question or make a comment there. Inauguration Day is coming around, Tom Sherwood. And as usual, Adam Eidinger has an original proposal for Inauguration Day. He is calling on everyone to, toke up on Inauguration Day, and he's going to
there are a lot of millennials
providing
who don't
the
use
materials.
The word toke
for
up. We don't have to explain what
he's that calling means. On people to smoke marijuana on Election
well, he's,
Day.
Well, let's be exactly accurate so he doesn't get into any legal trouble. Adam
yes.
Eidinger, who is a longtime advocate for the good uses of marijuana, the legalization of marijuana, plans on from 8 o'clock to 10 o'clock January 20th, if you really want to know the details, on the west side of DuPont Circle, he and his supporters of legal marijuana are going to pass out, they say, 4,200 individual marijuana cigarettes to anyone who wants them. It's legal for the to possess marijuana on city property. It's not legal anywhere to smoke it, whether you're on federal or local city property. It's not legal to smoke marijuana in public. So if you are one of the 4,200 people who go to get one of these cigarettes, you should not smoke it in public unless you want to be arrested.
That's true. Adam is calling on people to light up at 4 minutes and 20 seconds into the inauguration speech. That's a play on 420, the code for pot.
He told me that he would not be lighting up in public.
Adam himself would not be lighting up in public?
He told me he would not be, but he said it's an individual decision for people. You know, the police will have a lot to do that day. We'll talk to our guests about this. There's a little concern within the police community or the law enforcement community about the anti-Trump people who are coming to town and the aggressively very strong pro-Trump people who are coming to town who don't want to put up with any foolishness. And so it's going to be a risky weekend, I think.
Are you suggesting that the anti-Trump people are going to be up to foolishness?
Well, I talked to the ACLU, which is right down the street from here, and they are saying that some people want to get arrested. You know, the anarchists who have been around for a long time, they're not large in number, but it doesn't take many of them to create some kind of havoc in which other people start acting out. The police have their hands full for this inauguration week. And then that's the next day is the Women's March, and then the week later is the March for Life, where there's going to be a substantial number of people coming for that because they have new hope and that there's going to be more restrictions on abortion. So there's a lot going on in the next 2.5-3 weeks in this nation's capital.
Our guest is Vincent Gray. He's a D.C. council member representing Ward 7. He is the former mayor of the District of Columbia. Council Member Gray, congratulations. Happy New Year. Welcome.
Thank you very much, Kojo. I noted the opening when you said that the show starred Tom Sherwood.
Yes, that's correct. Don't forget that.
Okay.
Well, listen, you were the mayor in 2013. After the Obama inaugurals were pretty low-key. The first one was big because there's so many people came, but the second one was pretty kind of standard and wasn't a lot of trouble. But you're aware with the intensity of the feeling against Trump, the intensity of the feeling for Trump as the former mayor, as someone involved. What are your own? The mayor today had a press conference, I should say, with the Secret Service at noon, Mayor Bowser did, and the police department, and they're going to put on the website, inauguration.dc.gov, all the details about road closures and restrictions so people can plan. But Mr. Mayor, Mr. Councilmember, how worried should we be with the intensity of the politics of the past year?
I think we have to be deeply concerned, given the sentiments that we saw expressed throughout the presidential campaign. We saw, you know, these Trump rallies. We saw people being dragged out of rallies that he was involved in. And my fear is that we'll have, you know, a confluence, a concentration of people around the inaugural who will want to have an opportunity to express those sentiments. We know that I think the day after the inauguration itself, there's going to be a march.
Right.
You know, for us in the District of Columbia, we've been through things like this before, especially threats to our future, if you will. And we've simply got to be able to stay the course and continue to work hard.
The police department, since the early 2000s, when there was some concern, the city had to pay out millions of dollars because of mistreating of the protesters. The police department has done almost a 180 in how it approaches demonstrations, trying to more likely corral them and keep them orderly as best as possible, rather than busting people and arresting them and hand tying them and all that kind of stuff. And so they say they're ready. It's just that the difference now is that the intensity of the pro-Trump people who don't want to put up with the anarchist types, and they could take it upon themselves. And, you know, 98% of the people coming are just coming for the inauguration.
Correct.
But it just seems to me we all do have to be alert.
Well, there's absolutely no doubt about that. You know, we've got a very experienced police leadership in this city. You know, if you think back to it, I guess almost since the turn of the century, we've only had a couple of police chiefs. We had Chief Ramsey, who was here and then went on to Philadelphia. And then we had Chief Lanier, who, you know, served under two mayors, including me. And we now have an interim chief who's very experienced. So I think We've seen almost everything imaginable in the District of Columbia, and I'd like to think, and I do think, that our police department is ready to be able to handle these issues.
Yeah, that's Chief Pete Newsom.
Correct, yeah.
You were sworn in earlier this week. You're on a very different council than the one you worked with as mayor and before that as council chair. How do you see the dynamic of this council now? It's often been described as a more progressive council than we had before, but Washington has always had progressive councils.
That's right. And I think we'll continue to have, progressive issues, initiatives on the table. I've spent a lot of time. We had on December 3rd a summit in Ward 7 where we brought together. We had hoped we'd get 150 people to show up, and we had 400 people who came out to be a part of a very organized effort to have the people living in and working in Ward 7 to express the sentiments of what they think should be our efforts going forward. So we've now put together a plan, an action plan that will guide our work on behalf of the people of Ward 7. And there's no question that, a lot of the initiatives that we've heard about have a cross-cutting importance that, we've seen the family leave legislation and went through. But we've also, got other issues that are on the table as well. There's many people in Ward 7, for example, who are deeply concerned about public safety, concerned about economic development, concerned about education. So we'll continue to pursue those initiatives. I have some thoughts of legislation I want to introduce fairly early in this term. So we'll continue to have an emphasis on progressive initiatives, but I think quality of life issues will be deeply important to lots of people across the city.
Let's go to one big political issue, and that's the paid family leave matter. There were two proposals. One was the one that passed, which would set up a new employee tax to pay for it. It'll take a couple of years to get it in place. The other, the business community said, well, let's just make it a mandate and just tell people you have to provide this legislation, not create a new government agency. Had you been on the council, would you have voted for the mandate, just telling business that they should do this, or would you have voted for the plan to create a new government agency to regulate it and actually operate a paid family leave? And I also heard that maybe you made some phone calls lobbying during this period of time.
I talked to one person.
LaRubin, was it?
No, it was not.
Okay. The mayor has not yet decided. Well, she hasn't publicly said whether she's going to veto this legislation, in which case the council, your council, you would have to vote whether to override or not, or whether she'll let it go into law without her signature. Where are you?
Well, I guess I'll have to make that decision based on whether she vetoes the bill or not. If she vetoes, it'll be back in front of the council, and I'll have to make some decisions at that stage. And if that should happen, I will talk to lots of people along the way.
You didn't particularly like the expense and the two-thirds of the benefits going to the suburbs.
No, absolutely not.
We're building the city agency for the burbs.
The expense of setting up, a new agency also, which will be tens of millions of dollars, is something I'm deeply concerned about, because those are resources that certainly could be devoted to other purposes, needed purposes in the District of Columbia. And again, it's almost like a reverse commuter tax, that we've got, two-thirds of the people who will benefit from this that don't actually live in the District of Columbia. So I don't find that exciting at all. But, again, I'll make a decision on what I'm going to do should it come back before the council.
Well, in that point of view that you just expressed, you seem to be essentially on the same page on this issue as Mayor Bowser. And there are those who feel that Vincent Gray is coming back to the council not only to represent Ward 7, but that he has something to prove. He has to get back at Mayor Muriel Bowser. Tell us a little bit about what your intentions are about that relationship.
I think that is so non-constructive to come back with that attitude. That doesn't benefit the people of Ward 7. I've had people to ask me, is this just a precursor for another run at being mayor?
I wasn't going to ask you that, because I figured
I've asked it at least four times.
I figured Tom had asked it.
And I bet you the answer has been consistent every time, hasn't it, Tom?
It's a very good answer. It's not a no, but it's not a yes either.
That's right. And that is the truth. I have now made a decision of what I'm going to do. I think both of you gentlemen know that I loved the job of being the mayor of the District of Columbia. I was born and raised in this city, and being able to serve the people of the city is a great honor. And I think if you look back on the time we served as mayor, this city did very well. If you look at the job growth and development, if you look at public safety, you look at education, you look at almost any index that's important to the people who live in the city, we made improvement on those
except
fronts.
For one, maybe. On January 1st, the New York Times did a piece on homelessness in the District of Columbia. Yeah. And it said, since her election in 2014, Mayor Muriel Bowser has made homelessness a higher priority than her more stringent predecessor did, extending the availability of shelters beyond the cold weather months when there is a threat of hypothermia. What happened during your watch on the issue of homelessness? It seemed to increase, and you seem to be somewhat surprised by it.
Well, I think we knew that homelessness had the potential to increase. And one of the things we did, and they're probably talking about the family's issue, there's nothing more destabilizing for a family, you know, a mom and a dad, if you got both involved. Certainly we had many situations in which the dad, you know, was involved, but mostly it was moms and young children. There's nothing more destabilizing to be in a situation involving homelessness. We spent a lot of energy, Kojo, trying to keep people where they had been previously. Why did you become homeless? What are the factors that accounted for that? It wasn't so much that we were trying to be stringent in that regard. We were simply trying to keep as much stability in the lives of those families as we possibly could. We paid the rent for people. We bought food for people. We did all kinds of things in order to keep people in the situation they had been previously in. A lot of times that worked out as we worked then to try to get them into a more stable housing situation. You know, what we have now is a situation where people come in. I think we've got year-round policies, you know, in terms of homeless families. And you look at the numbers have gone through the roof at this stage. We had a plan also to close D.C. General. D.C. General has not been closed yet. I think there are 250 families who are housed there. And then we've got lots of families who are in hotels. Just as an example, we had, you know, 250, just like now, families in D.C. General. But we had gotten the numbers of families down to about 130, 135 families who were in hotels. The last time I counted, we had over 500 families who were in hotels. That is very destabilizing. So it wasn't a matter of being stringent. It was trying to keep some stability in the lives of these families, especially these young children.
We want to talk about homelessness just a little bit more because that's what Naya in Northeast Washington wants to talk about. Put on your headphones, please, gentlemen, okay. So we can hear what Naya has to say. Naya, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Good morning. Thank you for having me, Kojo. I enjoy your show. Councilwoman, thank you for being on the show, and congratulations. I'm a resident of Ward 7. I live in Deanwood. My husband and I have been there in Deanwood for over 10 years, and we've noticed in the past few months that there's been a lot of turnover of property in the neighborhood. Deanwood has been on the verge for a long time, and it appears that it's starting to be a community of interest for a lot of people. There's good and bad that comes with that. One of the other things that we've seen is that there are several major projects in coming about in Deanwood. One is the Strand Theater Project. Another one is the Deanwood Hills Project. Both of them are being done.
What is your concern, Naya?
Developer. My concern is that it seems that a lot of the projects are geared towards affordable housing. And while affordable housing is important, it is also really important to be sure that we get a good mixed income community out of whatever the development is that happens so that we can draw the amenities that the community desires. And we don't want to see all of the affordable housing projects efforts that could have been made in wards 1 through 6 pushed over into Ward 7 and 8 as the final frontier, and we end up with no opportunity for mixed income.
Councilmember Gray Hurd is on the one hand. You've got people complaining that they're being priced out of the city. There's not enough affordable housing. Then there's somebody in your ward who's saying, well, don't put it all in our ward.
I don't think anybody should conclude either that affordable housing is synonymous with public housing. As a matter of fact, one of the things in Ward 7 that we're working to do is to try to move the whole new communities effort along. I was the one that introduced Lincoln Heights, which is a housing development, to the new communities effort. And so the affordable housing that we're talking about, those could be incomes. You know, if you look at the AMI, the area median income, is now $109,000 for a family of four people. That's a lot of money. So I don't think we should conclude that we're simply recreating public housing with affordable housing.
More like workforce housing. People
yeah, it
have
is.
Jobs.
It really is. That's exactly right,
both.
John. That's exactly right. And, you know, one of the things we're trying to do is give people an opportunity to stay in the District of Columbia. There are lots of people who feel like they're being priced out and they won't be able to afford to continue to live in the city. One of the things that I did as mayor was I started the process of investment in affordable housing. We put my first year doing this, we put $100 million in. The next year, we put $287 million in. And if you look at some of the housing that's been built as a result of this, people would walk past that and not recognize it as being any different than any other kind of housing that is being developed in the city.
Mr. Mayor, I'm going to call you Mr. Mayor. Let's make it simpler. You know, there are issues.
You're the one that said I always have the title.
That's right. You do. All right. The issue is that we have single persons, men, mostly men and some women, who need lots of assistance. You just go down to Franklin Park and Square downtown, you see hundreds of people who just need help. And then you have the families you mentioned. Mayor Bowser has made a dramatic proposal this year, which was slow to get through the council, to put a homeless shelter, essentially 50 families, in each of the 7-8 wards. Where are you on that? Have you looked at that proposal and how it's affecting Ward 7? Is that a good thing she's done? There's some concern in Ward 3 about how big it is, where it's going to be. There was issues in Ward 5 and other places. Overall, though, it seems like a good idea to disperse family housing rather than just have it all in one spot, and to close DC General, which you also want to do.
Well, absolutely.
Politically, that's a big deal.
I think the idea of dispersing people, of having, you know, every area of the city be a place that provides support for people who are homeless is a good idea. But even if you do the math on that, we still will have lots of families who have not been served. You know, just do the math of, you know, eight wards times 50 people. That's still a lot of people who have to be served. The more important issue for me, Tom, mm-hmm. frankly, is to be able to create more housing that people can go into, to get them back into stable, permanent housing. Excuse me. And that was the goal that we had with what we were doing to close D.C. General and to make these major investments in affordable housing.
And Mayor Bowser has committed $100 million a year for this to push housing faster and better.
It continues the commitment that we made.
Right, okay.
On that issue, here is Brian in Ward 1. Brian, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
This is Brian
good
Weaver.
Afternoon. No, not okay. at all. Good afternoon.
He just happens to be in Ward 1.
Right? I'm sorry.
He wants to talk about Ward 7.
Go ahead, sir.
I'm sorry about that.
Go ahead, sir.
Welcome back to the council, Mayor Gray.
Thank you.
I am a developer in Ward 7. One of my projects is Park 7 in Hayes Street.
Mm-hmm.
So I want to point out that the young lady who called and Naya said that too much affordable housing in Ward 7. And the board that I serve on, DCFHA, we think that it is a concentration of too much affordable housing east of the river, and we need to make sure that it gets spread in Ward 3 and Ward 2 and throughout the city. But I want to also let people understand that when we talk about 80% and 60% AMI, it still raised the income level in Ward 7 and Ward 8. So when people hear affordable housing, we don't want everybody to assume that it's a low income people that's always moving to these wards. Some of these units, you have to average $60,000 to $70,000 or $80,000 to live in. And that's still, you know, an increase of the income in some parts of Ward 7. So
and
it's a balance in there.
So as Mayor Gray said before, this is not all public housing, so to speak.
Exactly. And when you go back to $109,000 being the area median income for a family of four, that's not small money.
Tom Sherwood, several parking lots around RFK Memorial Stadium, according to the Post, would be turned into a $490 million complex comprised of a spacious sports center, community market, and a new memorial to Robert F. Kennedy Jr. That's a major development.
I was at that meeting last night with a variety of local politicians, one of whom is sitting here to my left. This is a major deal. You know, this is roughly, and Mayor, correct me, it's about 190 acres if you think about the RFK mm-hmm. space, the 10,000 parking lots, mm-hmm. the armory, the D.C. General property that butts up next to the jail. There's a lot of space there. The people who live up there, They want open space for families. They want activities. They want retail. They don't want just, for example, a football stadium. Mm-hmm. This plan put out by the Vince DC, which runs the stadium, and is remarkable. It's almost a $500 million of things for families to do. Now, one person told me, well, this is, if you do all this, so then you can put a Redskins stadium right in the middle. It would be great. Now, Mayor, you were there last night. You saw a big crowd. People were paying attention. There was an orderly meeting. Some people are worried sick that some Redskins stadium will be there. Others were just delighted. You've got the brochure there, and that this could be amazing amenity for the people. It's in your ward, much of it.
I think the overwhelming majority of the people, at least certainly last night, view this as a catalyst for a different kind of presence than RFK Stadium has been since, I guess, 1960.
8 weeks of hell a year.
And, but it won't be 10,000 parking spaces. This will be really developed.
This will be really developed. 190 acres, I think you mentioned, Tom, is absolutely right, that we'll have just a different kind of presence than we've had before. I think a lot of people are looking forward to having the kind of recreational opportunities, the continued cleanup of the Anacostia River, the continued creation of amenities that otherwise would not exist. One of the things that was a little disappointing for me last night was because RFK now is in Ward 7.
Yes, I know.
It butts, of course, Ward 6. And my sense was that there were not a huge number of Ward 7 residents there last night. And that's on us. You know, we've got to get people engaged. I was thinking this morning in a meeting that we had that I want to bring the Events DC people out to Ward 7 and have them have a series of meetings in Ward 7.
Well, they've had some at St. Coletta's there, right next to the stadium.
That's Ward 6.
Yes, but a lot of people complained that it was downtown at the convention center.
That's right. So, we've got to get them out into the neighborhoods that are going to be affected. I mean, we got, you know, Kingman Park was represented there last night. I talked to the ANC commissioner for Kingman Park. So we had a few people from Ward 7, but we've got to do more. I don't want to see these decisions move forward, and then we have people from Ward 7 feel like these decisions were made without their involvement.
People from Ward 7 who will say, is this being built for us?
Yeah, right.
Or is it really being somebody else?
I think the good thing is the development, which is a lot of activity space, retail space, community space, it sounds really good in the presentation of it. But you, Mr. Mayor, when you spoke last night, you spoke right up and said the possibility that the Washington Redskins, if things were to be worked out properly, they were to build their own stadium and stuff like that, could be worked out, but there'd be a lot of discussion about that. You tried as mayor to get the team to commit to town.
Mm-hmm.
Mayor Bowser is doing the same thing. Tony Williams did before you, so did Adrian Finty. That's a decision will be made in the next couple of years. Where are you on that? Can they be a partner with this major project here, or will they be in trouble there?
Well, I think it's going to be a stretch. You know, I've seen the proposal to create a 20,000-seat arena, to create the possibility of a new stadium. You know, the sentiment I heard in the room last night, frankly, was more of the kinds of amenities that will serve the people, you know, children and you know, young families who live in that area of the city. I heard almost no support, really, for a new football stadium being in that area. And frankly, you know, having watched the team the last couple of years, especially last weekend.
Well, you know, Jack Evans is the councilman who's most forward bringing the team back. And he says there is a curse on the team, that the team will never win again until it
recreates. There are other people who believe there are other reasons there is a curse on the team.
Like the talent on the field, right?
We won't go there. We won't go there. But before you go, there's one issue we have to discuss, albeit quickly. Among your priorities is a focus on the criminal justice system, which the outgoing chief of police described as broken. There's been a lot of discussion of the issues with D.C. justice system in the past several months, including a series in the Post outlining serious problems with youth justice. What are the biggest issues as you see it and some of the ways in which you intend to tackle it?
Well, I look at what, you know, what's happening in Ward 7, and the homicides have gone up. You know, I'm proud of the fact that we have brought homicides in the city down tremendously. We had one year when we were down to 88. The largest number we had was 108. And one of those years actually included the 12 homicides at the Navy Yard, which is not the kind of situation that most people think of. So I've got a couple of proposals that I'm going to pursue, including efforts that would try to stabilize the current Metropolitan Police Department. We have an authorized strength of 4,000, and we aren't anywhere near that at this stage. We're more like down close to 3,700 at this stage, which has certainly got an impact on communities like Ward 7. So I'd like to get the strength up to 4,200, work hard with a variety of incentives to be able to get people to want to work in the Metropolitan Police Department. And, frankly, to do as much as we can to start to bring these homicide levels down. We were up to, I think, we were 31 in 2015 in Ward 7. In 2016, we were up to 39. That's just intolerable. And, you know, it's so hard to get people who are interested in economic development to want to move into areas where crime is that level of a problem.
Let me ask one quick political question. Kenyon McDuffie was the chairman of the Judiciary Committee. He gave it up. He said he didn't want to be the chairman anymore, wanted to do something else. Charles Allen is now from Ward 6. Some people mentioned Kenyon McDuffie as a potential candidate for mayor. Was that a good move for him to give up public safety? That's one of the biggest issues for any mayor.
I don't know why he did that. You know, you'd have to ask him what his reasons were. I'm actually on the Judiciary Committee, and I wanted to be on that, and I'm delighted to do that in addition to now chairing the Health Committee. But it will give me an opportunity on the Judiciary Committee to pursue some of these issues that affect the quality of life of people in Ward 7 every day.
Vincent Gray is a D.C. council member representing Ward 7. He's the former mayor of the District of Columbia. I was supposed to see you on New Year's Eve, but had the worst allergy attack I've had in ages. You sound a little hoarse yourself today, as a matter of fact.
Yeah,
are you?
I hope not.
Bobby's just sitting next to Tom that's causing that.
Well, I didn't get a chance to ask him about the hospital he wants to build east of the river, but maybe the next time.
Well, we've been working on that.
I know. I'm aware of it.
We need a health care system.
That's why you wanted to be the chairman of that committee.
We need a health care system, and we've got opportunities that are available to us, and we're going to pursue that, Tom.
Tom Sherwood is our resident analyst.
Big political
issue. He's a reporter for NBC4. He's a columnist of the current newspapers. Vincent Gray, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Coming up next, Sharon Bulliver. She's the chairman of the Fairfax County Board of Supervisors. You can call 800-433-8850. Send email to kojo@wamu.org. Shoot us a tweet at Kojo Show or go to our website, kojoshow.org. Watch the live video stream of the broadcast there. You can also send your questions or comments there also. Former Congressman of Virginia Tom Perriello made a late and startling entry, according to the Washington Post, into the race for governor Thursday, challenging Governor Terry McAuliffe's chosen successor in what had been a clear path to the Democratic nomination. It's not going to happen that easily after all, Tom Sherwood. Tom Perriello says, I'm in this thing.
Well, you know, the best laid plans of the Virginia Democratic Party went out the window. And I don't know if Tom Perriello.
Perriello.
I always say his name wrong, you know, from the South, we get that license. I'm going to go ahead and interview Sharon Bulliver, who's arrived. The Democrats were all set for the governor's race this year. Ralph Northam, lieutenant governor, moving up. Mark Herring said, oh, I'll run for attorney general again. It's all set. Maybe the lieutenant governor thing is the only undecided thing. And now the former congressman, a one-term congress member, says, I think I'll run. He's kind of the Bernie Sanders of the campaign. Where are you on the governor's race that confronts the Democrats and Republicans this year right now? And what do you think about Tom? Would you call him up and tell him not to do this?
And on behalf of Tom Sherwood, welcome and Happy New Year.
Well, we were right to the issue.
Thank you so much. So
welcome.
This was as big a surprise to me as it was to everyone else. And I've been a supporter of Ralph Northam. I think he's a very fine gentleman, has done a good job as lieutenant governor. And I think he's my choice for governor. I think he'll be outstanding.
You know, Mark Warner and Tim Kaine, everybody, it's kind of like what happened over in Maryland last time around when Anthony Brown had the entire Democratic Party behind him, but he lost to the Republican. But in this case, are you, and I realize this just happened in the last couple of days, but it really does blow up what was seen as a very well-organized Democratic Party, and that's not usually what you put together, well-organized in Democrats.
To me, it feels unusual for the Democrats. And I actually had lunch yesterday with a member of the editorial page for the Washington Post.
Ooh.
And he asked me the question about did I think that there would be any competition, you know, among the Democratic Party for the governor's race? And my answer was no. little did I know that at the very same time we were having lunch and discussing that subject that there appears to be competition.
And when the lieutenant governor's race, Mr. Fairfax, I think, can't think of his full name, is running for lieutenant governor. Isn't it time for maybe there to be a woman on the ticket in Virginia?
And actually, Justin Fairfax is who you were thinking of. And I think that would be outstanding to have a woman on the ticket. Delegate Eileen Fillercorn, for a period of time, had been considering a run for lieutenant governor. She had actually started traveling around the state and apparently decided it was not her time.
Not something you would do.
No, that would sort of be jumping from the frying pan into the fire.
Let's talk, speaking of frying pan and fires, let's talk Metro. You are concerned about the suggestion by a Metro board member. The completion of the Silver Line extension to Dulles be held hostage, if you will, to pressure Richmond into coughing up more money for Metro. What are the issues as far as you're concerned, and what does the Silver Line mean for the economy of Fairfax? I know the money doesn't really come from Richmond at all.
Well, the Silver Line is not something that we just decided to do a couple of years ago to extend the Metro system to Dulles Airport. It's a critical component of the Metro system, a number one priority for transportation in Northern Virginia and specifically Fairfax County and also Loudoun County. And it is not being built by WMATA. And so funds are not coming from Metro. It's coming from
Airport Authority.
From the Airport Authority, but it's coming from special tax districts of landowners who own property along the corridor. And also we are aided by a federal loan, a TIFIA loan, that is helping to pay for this major transportation project. Not only will the Silver Line serve Northern Virginia, but it will serve Washington, D.C. It will serve Maryland. The Silver Line is,
And I think that's precisely the point that the district officials want to make, because they are in favor of a dedicated funding source for Metro and are willing to approve a tax of some sort. And they seem to get the distinct impression that Virginia officials are not even willing to raise that issue with their constituents.
And actually, that's not exactly correct. So Virginia has not said, no, we won't contribute toward an additional funding source for Metro. And I personally feel that that's something that is going to have to happen for there to be additional revenue for both operating as well as capital in order for Metro to be able to continue.
Are you listening, Jack Evans?
But yes.
Well, Governor McAuliffe was on the program a couple of weeks ago. The year, and he was saying he acknowledged that you just can't tell somebody to do better and we'll give you more money, that there will have to be some funding.
There will need to be more funding. We also need to make sure that we are addressing, and I think that Metro is addressing, safety issues. The Safe Track program, I think, is really needed and is something that we're supportive of. I'm very supportive of Mr. Wiedefeld and his strategy for trying to, bring things into a better condition for safety, a better safety culture. So safety, governance, frankly, making sure that, the jurisdictions are working together in order to address the needs of Metro are all things that need to be, need to be part of the equation.
What happens if Mr. Wiedefeld says we can't afford to run cars out on the Silver Line to Dulles?
That's just silly.
Our guest is Sharon Bulliver. She is the chairman of the Fairfax County Board of Supervisors. Give us a call if you have questions or comments at 800-433-8850. Maybe there is some reason for the nervousness of Virginia officials about taxes, because Fairfax has top-tier schools. One of your priorities is to invest in those schools. But since we spoke last, the meals tax referendum failed in November when put before voters. You supported that 4% tax on restaurant meals and prepared food. who's making the argument that it was needed to support schools. So what does the result now mean for schools in particular and the county's budget in general?
So it won't be an easy budget.
When is it due? When do you have to have a proposal?
So the budget begins actually with the school superintendent, and we have an interim school superintendent right now. Dr. Garza has departed, but the superintendent of schools will advance the school budget. That will be in January. Okay. Then the county executive will put his advertised budget on the table in mid-February. Okay. And then a lot of discussion happens, public hearings, community meetings, and we adopt a budget by the end of April.
Okay, so as Kojo says, where's the money going to come from? You don't have it.
So it's, you know, it would have been nice had we had the additional revenue. Not just nice, but it would have, you know, it would have really
crucial.
Been helpful to our being able to improve teacher salaries, which have lagged behind the region. But we'll do the best we can with what we have. And the schools understand that. We're working very closely with the school board. So I've convened a joint Board of Supervisors school board budget development committee, and we're working well in advance of the adoption of the budget.
Does that include both revenue enhancement, tax increases,
and that
cuts?
I frankly would doubt that we would increase the real estate tax rate as part of this budget. We did that last year. 4 cents, and that was a pretty good hike. And some people didn't think that was pretty good.
Right.
It was about it was about $300
annual bill. What other tax you don't get many sources of revenue. What can you raise? But what could you raise?
Right. And actually, that really is the dilemma of counties in Virginia. So we have the real estate tax, we have the car tax, and that makes up about 80% of the revenue that we have to provide local services.
Do more parking tickets like the district does.
In December, the Fairfax Board of Supervisors established a police civilian review panel. The idea is to restore public trust after incidents, including the shooting death by police of John Gere back in 2013. I was going to ask the general question, how will this panel help build trust and transparency? But I'm going to defer to a more specific question we got by way of a tweet from Cat in the Hat. Why don't Fairfax's new independent auditor and civilian review panel have authority to investigate, ask questions, or participate in disciplinary acts?
Part of the charge to the Ad Hoc Police Practices Commission was for them to bring us recommendations to increase transparency, and essentially what we're doing is to re-engineer an excellent police department into, I think, an even better police department. Consistent with, and this is the operative word, consistent with Virginia law. And for us to give authority to a body like the new independent auditor and also the review panel to be able to conduct their own investigations, that would not be consistent with Virginia law. And so, what we'll be doing is working, you know, making sure that both of those bodies have the access that they need to the Commonwealth Attorney's Office and internally to Fairfax County when an internal review is being conducted. We did not want to create a body that would not be in concert with Virginia law.
So let me ask a couple of quick questions about it. How many members will there be when it's put in place? Is it nine?
So there will be nine members.
Nine members. And during this month, right now, the board is looking for people to volunteer to serve on the board. It's a non-paying, voluntary board. You're looking for people who have some expertise in either public safety or human relations, all those types of things. Who will actually sit down and say, okay, you are going to be on the board, you're not? Would the whole board do it? Will you do it? Will it be a vote? How will that be done? And it'll be done in February, I would guess.
Right. And so this will by the end of January, we should have received resumes, bios from folks, people who are listening, who are interested. They should send their expression of interest along with a bio or along with a resume to chairman@fairfaxcounty.gov. I will have first crack at going through the resumes along with Supervisor John Cook, who is chairman of our board's Public Safety Committee. And so we will put a slate together of what we feel is a good panel.
And the board votes for it.
And then the board will have the opportunity to take a look at that slate, make changes or suggest changes, and eventually it will be the full board that will vote on the first panel.
The reason I bring this up is because it's going to take a while, because once they get the board in place, they then have to write their rules, create their own chairman, and then by then, this board probably won't really be functioning until maybe late fall, maybe sometime in the fall or later.
I would say that's probably okay. About correct.
For people who are expecting it to jump right in.
This is Washington. Nothing happens that fast.
No, it's the suburbs.
Well, it's a part of the
it's
Washington
even better,
region.
Right?
Beyond transparency and building trust between the public and police, another priority for you is establishing a process to improve interactions between individuals suffering from mental illness and the criminal justice system. It's called Diversion First. Can you explain that?
Yes. Diversion First is something that was created actually about a year ago or put into place about a year ago with an actual facility, the Merrifield Mental Crisis Center. And fortunately, we had that center. It was relatively new when we also adopted a new policy, a new procedure for Diversion First, where someone who is having a psychotic breakdown or is, you know, has broken the law and is picked up by law enforcement has the option of, instead of taking that person to jail, taking them instead to the Merrifield Mental Health or Crisis Center and helping that person to be able to receive treatment and evaluation rather than incarceration. We've already diverted more than 300 people who otherwise might have ended up in jail.
Let me ask, there's a real question, you know, in the whole criminal justice system about whether minorities, particularly African Americans, are treated well. Are there even numbers of those 300 or so? Are African Americans or Hispanics being given that option as much as, say, white people might be arrested? That just seems to me that's such a racial concern.
We got a tweet from Serge Nova saying, Serge, why, if only 8% of people in Fairfax are black, 40% of police use of force is against black people? I can't confirm those numbers, but those are the numbers.
Right, but that's the concept of
right.
people
and,
concerned
and,
about it.
And what I'll say is, that is a concern that we're making sure that, that there is not disparity, in law enforcement. And in the way people are treated.
You know exactly how people would say a rich white kid or something will get taken to a hospital, a poor black kid will be taken to jail. So I presume there's training for the police officers and monitoring of that.
Absolutely. And there's training and, you know, making sure that police officers are treating everyone fairly, whatever the person's race, whatever the person's, cultural background, that person is to be treated fairly and has the option of receiving treatment rather than incarceration.
On to climate change. Here is Joe in Arlington,
climate
Virginia.
Change in Fairfax County.
Joe, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Thank you. Actually, it's Falls Church, but I'm with the on the board of directors with a local nonprofit called Faith Alliance for Climate Solutions. We met with the chairman yesterday, and I just wanted to thank her for all the hard work she's been doing in this area. I wasn't able to attend the meeting, but I got word that she was talking about reconstituting some sort of citizen advisor committee, I believe it is, to help move the county forward in the area of
Could you give us more information on that? We only have about two minutes left.
When I was first elected chairman in 2009, I convened an organization, a group, that is, called the Private Sector Energy Task Force, with the mission of looking at how we can improve energy efficiency among the private sector. And we had some very, very good recommendations. It was an excellent group. And a lot of good work has happened since. And Fairfax County itself has also made much progress in energy efficiency, sustainability. And so when I met with the Faith Alliance this week, I suggested that I might want to get that group back together again so that we could showcase Fairfax County's environmental agenda, but we could also showcase some of the private sector progress that has been made.
Getting the group back together
20 seconds
sound
on
like
the same subject.
Go ahead.
Supervisor Dan Stock was saying 80% of the streams in Fairfax County are rated as only fair and poor. You're urbanizing your county rapidly. What about anything you can quickly say about that? 80% of the field streams are fair or poor.
Yeah, and obviously that is not okay. Our environmental agenda includes energy efficiency, but also water quality, air quality, and making sure that we're addressing water. We actually created a stormwater utility fee, which is a portion of the real estate tax that is dedicated towards stormwater and stream improvement.
We just have barely enough time to mention the passing this week of Charles Colgan, the longest-serving member of the Virginia General Assembly. He passed at 90 years old. I'm sure both you and Tom are familiar with Charles Colgan.
Fine
a true
man.
Virginia gentleman.
Yes.
Sharon Bolivar, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much, Kojo. Enjoyed it.
That's it for the show today, but if you want to learn more about the move Fairfax County is making to create a civilian board to review police complaints similar to one currently at work in the district, we talked about it late last year with a trio of guests invested in the matter. You'll find it in the producer's pick section of our website at kojoshow.org. Enjoy the weekend. Stay warm. Then be sure to meet us back here Monday at noon. We'll talk about the continued debate about police-involved shootings in the district as an incident on Christmas triggers protests and the release of body cam footage. Until then, thank you all for listening. Tom Sherwood, you have a nice weekend.
Keep breathing, deep breathing.
And thank you all for joining us. I'm Kojo Nandi.
The Kojo Nandi Show is produced by Michael Martinez, Ingelisa Schrobsdorf, Taylor Burney, Elizabeth Weinstein, Ruth Tam, and Avery Kleinman. The engineer is Meg Bunting. Podcasts of all shows and audio archives are available at our website, kojoshow.org.
Thanks for listening to The Kojo Nandi Show, and if you're already a member of WAMU 88.5, thank you for your support. If not, it's easy to give online at WAMU.org. Just click the donate button, and thanks.